Senate Bill 1062 has Arizona drawing unwanted national attention again. And this time, business groups, Senators McCain and Flake, and even some lawmakers who voted for the bill are calling for Governor Jan Brewer to veto it. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Glenn Hammer, head of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, about why his group thinks the bill should be struck down and the possible fallout, even if it doesn't go any further. And longtime Capitol watcher Barrett Marson will discuss the legislature's choices and what the governor may do. Plus, historian Elizabeth Tandy Shermer has written about how business and politics crossed in the valley in the book Sunbelt Capitalism. We'll find out why she thinks Phoenix has influenced the rest of the country, and we'll get Grady Gamage's perspectives. And retired Lieutenant Colonel Jay Kopelman is in the Valley for a presentation called From Baghdad to America, Life After War. We'll discuss the challenges of returning from the battlefield. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. House Republicans are set to unveil their plan within the hour for overhauling and simplifying the nation's tax code. NPR's Craig Windham says the plan would sharply reduce the top personal income tax rate, which is now 39.6%, and impose a surcharge on some high-income households.
The seven current income tax brackets would be reduced to just 2, 10% and 25%. There would also be a 10% surtax on some types of earned income over about $450,000 a year. A nonpartisan congressional analysis of the plan reportedly finds that the vast majority of taxpayers would see little change in their total tax bills. The author of the plan is House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp, but Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell says he does not expect Congress to approve the measure.
I have no hope for that happening this year.
In this election year, lawmakers in both parties are wary of any proposal that would reduce popular tax breaks, such as the home mortgage interest deduction. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama is touting a plan today that relies on revenues raised by ending some tax breaks. This afternoon in St. Paul, Minnesota, Obama will announce a more than $300 billion strategy to fix the nation's roads, bridges, rail, and transportation infrastructure. He's asking Congress to renew federal funding for transportation programs before a September 30th deadline. Russian President Vladimir Putin has placed combat forces on high alert for war games near Ukraine, days after his Ukrainian ally, Viktor Yanukovych, was toppled from power and became that nation's most wanted fugitive. The Kremlin maintains the military drills involving some 150,000 Russian troops are not linked to the political upheaval in Ukraine. Meanwhile, thousands of ethnic Russians who form the majority in Ukraine's Crimea region are rallying for independence. Today, they clash with rival protesters who oppose Viktor Yanukovych. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is meeting his NATO counterparts in Brussels, where the tense standoff from the Afghan government over security guarantees and the situation in Ukraine are topping the agenda. Terry Schultz reports from NATO headquarters, where the possibility of a complete pullout from Afghanistan after 2014 now looks more possible.
On his way to Brussels, Hagel said it was a prudent step for the U.S. to start planning for the so-called zero option, getting completely out of Afghanistan at the end of the year, because Afghan President Hamid Karzai has refused to sign a security arrangement governing the continued presence of U.S. troops. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen reminds Karzai, if the U.S. leaves, so do all 50 NATO allies and partners.
This is not our preferred option, but it might be the unfortunate outcome.
Ministers will also discuss Ukraine. With reports Russia is testing the readiness of its forces, Rasmussen says he takes it for granted all nations respect Ukraine's borders. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz at NATO headquarters in Brussels.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Reputation.com, offering tools to manage online reviews for medical professionals and small businesses. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Good morning. From KJZZ News in Phoenix, I'm Bruce Drummond. An appeals court is set to hear arguments in March over a judge's order that Maricopa County pay $975,000 to supervisor Mary Rose Wilcox. The payment is to settle Wilcox's lawsuit over a failed corruption case brought against her. The settlement agreement was negotiated between Wilcox's lawyer and then county manager David Smith, but some county officials questioned whether Smith had the authority to resolve the case. A judge ruled in Wilcox's favor in the dispute, and the county appealed that decision. Wilcox and other county officials alleged Sheriff Joe Arpaio and former county attorney Andrew Thomas conducted groundless criminal investigations of them. Arpaio and Thomas maintain they were trying to root out corruption. Here's something that could test your nerves. Imagine driving across country in a van full of barking chihuahuas. KJZZ's Steve Shadley explains.
That's what will happen on Friday when more than 20 of the stray dogs will be transported from a Phoenix animal shelter to a small town in Pennsylvania where they'll be put up for adoption. Melissa Gable is with Maricopa County Animal Control. She says some parts of the valley have reported too many stray chihuahuas, but they aren't always easy to find back east.
In those colder climates, people tend to have labs and golden retrievers and hardy dogs, you know, and there's just not that many little itty-bitty chihuahua foo-foo dogs.
Gable says Arizona Chihuahua Rescue and Paws Too Hard have raised the money to transport the dogs. She says all of the chihuahuas have been spayed and neutered and will be outfitted with sweaters for the trip to the colder climate. Steve Shadley, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
KJZZ is supported by the Arizona Smokers Helpline. Smoking affects nearly every system in the body and costs the nation $167 billion in health care costs annually. More about how to help your employees quit tobacco at ashline.org.
In the Valley Forecast, look for partly cloudy to partly sunny skies today, high around 81 degrees. It'll be cloudy tonight with a low of 56. More clouds on Thursday, a high of 79. We'll see some winds up to 23 miles an hour in the afternoon. On Friday, there's a slight chance of rain and a high of 76. That chance of rain becomes 80% by Friday night. It's mostly sunny and 72 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, does it seem like the Arizona legislature has made a habit of passing controversial legislation? I'll talk with consultant Barrett Marson, who is the spokesman for then-State House Speaker Jim Wires, about why and whether anything could change that. Plus, a historian at Loyola University of Chicago argues in her book that Phoenix has been extremely influential in the conservative political movement, especially in the West. I'll talk with Elizabeth Tandy Shermer about Sunbelt capitalism. Grady Gamage will also offer his perspectives. Also, what's it like to return from the battlefield to what's supposed to be a normal life? Retired Lieutenant Colonel Jay Kopelman joins me in studio to talk about his presentation tonight at ASU. It's called From Baghdad to America, Life After War. And the Phoenix Coyotes are back on the ice tomorrow night following the NHL's lengthy break for the Winter Olympics. We'll find out what it will take for the team to get into the postseason. We start today's program with SB 1062, the bill passed by the Arizona House and Senate that is now in the hands of Governor Jan Brewer. Supporters say the bill is intended to protect businesses that decide not to serve gays and lesbians on the basis of sincerely held religious beliefs. But in the past few days, opponents of the legislation have loudly proclaimed its potential negative impact on Arizona, especially the economy. Even three state senators who voted for the bill have called on the governor to veto it. Business leaders have also been out front in criticizing the legislation, and that's why I turn now to Glenn Hammer, president and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce. Glenn, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on the program.
Good to have you with us. Give us a straight answer on this. Why is the chamber opposed to SB 1062?
It's bad for business, number one. It also has sent a message that Arizona, let me turn it into it, what Arizona is.
Okay.
We are a very welcoming society. We're a place you can come from anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, and climb the ranks. The way this bill has been interpreted by many is that it would make us a less inclusive destination. And for a state that relies on a lot of creative talent, particularly as our tech sector continues to grow, and when we have 200,000 jobs tied to the tourism sector, it obviously would have an economic impact.
How tough have the past 4 or 5 days been as far as the state's reputation, as far as perception is concerned?
Well, our expectation is that next week it'll be back to regular programming where we can talk about great weather and the great business climate. There's nothing permanent here, but it's vitally important that this bill not become law. And see, that's why virtually now every major business group in the state has come out against the legislation and has urged the governor to veto it. Our two U.S. senators have urged the governor to veto it. Five candidates running for governor as Republicans have urged the governor to veto it. And the grand finale, the Republican candidate for president last time around, Mitt Romney, has urged the governor to veto it. So it's pretty clear which way the momentum is going.
Glenn, how active is the business community, business leaders like yourself, before the legislative session starts? Because I was thinking back, I didn't attend the legislative luncheon, but I presume CPS came up, I presume other things came up, but this did not come up. Was this a surprise?
Yes. I mean, we were certainly aware of this bill, but we you know, chambers tend to work on meat and potato things affecting business. The tax climate, regulatory climate. We put a lot of effort, Steve, as you know, into improving our educational system. You know, we were focused on those efforts, and you know, this bill moved forward at a fairly rapid clip last week, and it's fair to say that I don't believe anyone in the business community, and I don't believe anyone who voted for or against this expected this to cause not only a national but an international media firestorm.
Glenn, I have to ask you, we have to go back to 1070 just because that's been the big issue, and the business community was criticized for not stepping up early enough in that, at least in terms of the perception of how Arizona was seen before the Supreme Court stepped in. Is the business community more active? And were there lessons learned after 1070, or are those not related?
Not related at all. And this is why everyone could agree, and everyone, I would say, proponents and opponents of 1070 agreed that immigration in this country was an absolute mess. Unfortunately, it still is, but that's probably a topic for another day. This bill, though, as far as we can tell, doesn't respond to any instance of religious issues that's occurred in the state of Arizona. I mean, as proponents have discussed cases that have come up in Colorado and New Mexico, but there has not been a case identified in Arizona, as far as I'm aware of, where there's a problem. Look, we all support religious liberties. That's extremely important, and we have state and federal constitutional protections. But it's vitally important that Arizona be seen as it is, and that's a very welcoming place. And you know, that's certainly one of the reasons why you have this great outpouring of support for the governor to veto the legislation.
Glenn, how might this affect who the chamber supports when it comes to the legislative primaries, even the gubernatorial primary?
Well, you know, Steve, it's fair to say we didn't take a position, and I don't believe any other major business group took a position when this was moving through the legislature. You know, right now our focus is on building the case so that the governor could veto this bill and we could get back to regular programming. I mean, right now, this is probably one of the two or three biggest stories, certainly in the country, if not in the world. You know, our hope is that the governor vetoes this, we could get back to business as usual, and we could talk about all the positive things that this state has to offer.
And Glenn, finally, so you feel like regular programming is going to come into effect, that the negativity, once this is gone, will not stick at all? There will not be a stain or a taint to Arizona?
I believe Arizona will be just fine. I mean, when you take a look at how the business community and political leaders of both parties and many leaders in the Republican Party, including Mitt Romney, have come forward, and our two U.S. senators in the state, no, I believe Arizona will be just fine, and we'll be talking about our great weather and business climate at this time next week.
Glenn Hammer, President and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce. Glenn, thanks as always for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. SB 1062 has Arizona values being debated on TV, radio, and social media. The state that The Daily Show's Jon Stewart called the meth lab of democracy seems to be at it again. To talk about that is consultant Barrett Marson, who was in the thick of the legislature when he was spokesman for former House Speaker Jim Wires. Barrett, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have been loud on Twitter when it comes to this. I want to hear what you think about 1062, and even the impact of it going forward on Arizona. But how does legislation like this, as Glenn mentioned, it does seem to be a solution in search of a problem. So how does legislation like this advance?
Well, there's a lobbyist for any issue. You know, there's a lobbyist who has an idea. They may even have a client, and they find a sympathetic lawmaker to push that idea. And so many bills down there go through the process without any attention, both from the media or the public. They do very little. They may have a special niche, if you will. And they go by, they're humdrum, and they, you know, remember, hundreds of bills get through and are signed by the governor. Maybe 20 get reported on.
It seemed especially interesting when Senator Steve Pierce, for one, also Bob Worsley, Adam Driggs, who actually voted for the bill. I don't want to say that these three are any worse than anybody else. They're certainly not. But is that illustrative of what you're saying, this idea that lawmakers just aren't paying enough attention to what they're voting on?
Well, it's, you know, again, you have maybe 500 bills in the Senate and 700 bills in the House, give or take. I'm not sure what the final bill count was, but literally hundreds of bills that you're looking at. And if you're not sitting on the committee that has heard those bills, you rely on a staff report or you rely on explanation from the sponsor. So, and, you know, I got to say, there are a lot of lawmakers who don't believe the bill does what everyone is saying that it does. So that is a frustration amongst certain lawmakers, like the three who have now come out asking for a veto. They don't actually believe that the law does what it does. And part of the reason they voted for it is because, well, they didn't want to be seen as voting against a religious freedom bill, considering they don't believe it does much.
Interesting. So how does leadership fit in on this? Where do we put Andy Biggs and Andy Tobin on this?
Well, you know, this was a bill that was sponsored by, of course, the popular and powerful Center for Arizona Policy. And that is anything that they're pushing, it is very hard to go against, to slow down that momentum. So certainly they believe in religious freedom. Again, they believe in religious freedom. And they're not for discrimination, but they truly believe that it is important that people be able to express their religion.
Is the legislative majority out of step with Arizona's majority? And has that gotten to be more the case, if it is true, over the past decade or more? As we've heard people complain about term limits. We've heard people complain about clean elections, for example.
Well, I'm certainly one of those people who believe that while clean elections is a good system, you have people who wouldn't be able to raise money who now have a voice, if you will, and that's a good thing. But they also appeal. They're not able to raise money for a reason, and they appeal to the base, whether it be Democrats or Republicans. And so they're appealing to a very small contingent, but a contingent that votes. And so it's going to be up to people like Glenn Hammer and other business community leaders to find candidates who more middle of the road, who are more concerned about policy, business policy and moving the state forward than the social issues.
Well, take us to the primary system, though. Does that get harder and harder because not enough people necessarily vote in the primaries? You have independents who can vote. A lot of them don't.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Well, I think you're going to have – this year is going to be a wonderful thing for democracy. I think we're going to see a lot more business community get involved in candidates selection more at the primary level, because let's face it, that is where people get elected, is at the primary. Districts now are so skewed in Arizona, both congressional and in the legislature, that the primary is the real election.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes left with consultant Barrett Marson. You can follow him on Twitter at Barrett Marson. That's two R's and two T's. Barrett, let's talk specifically more about 1062 then. You were shaking your head a little bit when Glenn was talking about maybe there not being a taint to Arizona after this. Do you think if the governor vetoes this, that taint goes away or no?
Well, it's 11:18 in the morning, so it must be time for another CNN story about how Arizona has this very discriminatory legislation. You know, 5 or 6 days of just beating the drum about how bad Arizona is and how much discrimination there is here in Arizona, we're going to get a good day if and when Governor Jan Brewer vetoes this bill. We're going to get a great day of press. But we've had 6 days where it's just pounding the state worldwide. And while the BBC is calling and Agence Française, all these news organizations, they're doing stories now. But if and when the bill gets vetoed, you know, they're going to have a smaller blurb saying it's been vetoed.
Even though the governor, we don't expect her to try to run for re-election against the Arizona Constitution, so let's say she's a lame duck and this is her last year. What, from a political standpoint, is she doing by meeting with groups on both sides or all sides, and not saying that when I fly back in Tuesday afternoon, I'm going to veto this.
Well, she does like to deliberate on bills. We've seen that in the past. She's a very deliberative person, and she wants to hear from all sides. I know that it's been loud on TV, on those interwebs, but there is no harm in her talking to people and forming her opinions, listening to people. However, this is one of those bills that have moved faster, if you will, than she could. She was in D.C. for much of the controversy, and so by the time she could get back, you know, she's meeting with people today. I know there's a lot of legislators going up to meet her in the early afternoon. So there's no harm necessarily in the usual course of things in meeting with people and talking, and that way you get all sides. However, we're paying for it on an hourly basis in the national media.
Barrett, finally, on the proverbial scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not shocked at all, 10 being completely shocked and you would fall over and collapse, where would you stand if the governor actually signs this?
I would stand at about, does it go to 11? Does this go to 11?
Okay. Barrett Marson of Marson Media. He was spokesman for former Arizona House Speaker Jim Wires. Barrett, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Here and Now, I'll talk with historian Elizabeth Tandy Shermer about her book, Sunbelt Capitalism, Phoenix and the Transformation of American Politics. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona State University, offering more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs. Class descriptions and registration online at radio.asu.edu.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. BBC News Hour starts at 1 o'clock. Checking conditions around the state right now, it's mostly sunny and 52 in Flagstaff, partly sunny skies and 58 in Prescott, sunny and 66 in Casa Grande, sunny and 70 in Tucson. Your cell phone can keep you linked to friends and family on social media and lets you stay on top of your busy schedule. And now you can connect to your news and information all day long with the new KJZZ app for your phone. You can stream KJZZ, get the latest news and podcasts, give us feedback, and more. Download your KJZZ app at the Apple App Store and Google Play. It's mostly sunny in Phoenix right now, 72 degrees. It's 11:22 at KJZZ.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. When Arizona's conservative movement is put into historical context, Senator Barry Goldwater is mentioned prominently, which makes sense since he was known as Mr. Conservative, and his 1964 presidential run, though it ended poorly for him, is credited with starting the movement that led to Ronald Reagan's 1980 election victory. In her book, Sunbelt Capitalism, Phoenix and the Transformation of American Politics, Loyola of Chicago history professor Elizabeth Tandy Shermer explores where Phoenix's growth crossed paths with an expanding business presence and the conservative political push. Elizabeth, was there a collective civic effort to make Phoenix the Southwest city of record instead of, at the time, Tucson or El Paso?
It really was this tremendous movement among a new generation of boosters coming into the Chamber of Commerce. And this is Barry Goldwater and his generation. Because it's really interesting that his father's generation and his contemporaries were really fine with Phoenix being, you know, the capital city, but a largely agricultural town. And a pit stop, actually, to be honest, for a lot of the cattle and the copper and the tourism that is coming into Phoenix in that period. But Goldwater and his generation, I really make the argument that it was the trauma of the Great Depression and realizing that tying their fortunes, because these are the merchants, these are the lawyers, these are the bankers, these are the small town gentry, if you will, who had a sense that, you know, were well educated. Many of them were educated outside of Arizona, going to places like Stanford, Harvard Business School, University of Michigan, Georgetown, that we were educated, we have the professional acumen, we have the national connections to do better than just to see our fortunes rise and fall with the price of cotton. And this idea that we should have investment in Phoenix, that we should be a manufacturing center, that there's a ton of potential. One of my favorite things that they drafted with the coming of World War II is an actual survey of the potential of Maricopa County and what it actually could do. And you really have this sense that these are men with a vision for a modern metropolis that came together to do it, both within the Chamber of Commerce in terms of enticing industry, negotiating with war with defense contractors, but also to get, you know, deeply involved in politics. This is a story just as much about Phoenix's economic transformation as its political transformation.
How important was it to have these boosters who were pushing the area as a great place for people to start a new life, in essence?
Sorry, I'm going to push you back. It's the historian in me. Push you back to the trauma of the Great Depression.
Okay.
Because that greatest generation that we think of as the post-war generation, really their visceral memories are from the economic devastation and the lack of opportunity in Phoenix. And for me, Phoenix during both the Great Depression, in terms of understanding just how devastating it would be to the city, but also World War II, when you see the promise of what it could be. In fact, one of the Phoenix boosters has this wonderful quote about how it seemed like New York City, the sidewalks were packed with not only war production workers, but military personnel, pilots being trained, and this sense about what the potential could be. But then when a lot of those military bases start to close down, when those war production factories start to shut down even before the wars end, because it's very clear the war is ending, you don't need the contract still that has been negotiated with Goodyear. There's this sense of, what do we do now? We have had this influx of people. We have felt the potential that this is what lifted Phoenix out of the Depression. What now? And the answer was so clearly that we need jobs and investment. And I think that when you look at that very first pivotal city council race in 1949, when Barry Goldwater wins with the slate, with many of with accompanied with other members of the Chamber of Commerce, it was this idea that we're going to put Phoenix on a sound business basis. But there is, as you sort of mentioned, there is concern about that it seems undemocratic.
How different was Phoenix from some of the larger, more established eastern cities? Why did it stand out so much? Was it just so vastly different?
It's amazing just the intimate connections that Phoenix had with some of those larger, more established cities. And the great city that Phoenix has all these connections to is Chicago, not only with the Benson brothers who ran Valley National Bank and also were key members of the Chamber of Commerce, but also with the connections to bring one of the first major investors into the Phoenix area after World War II, which was Motorola. And you can really see that connection. And when you actually look, and there's an example in the book about how Phoenix, to be quite honest, stole Motorola from Chicago, it is this argument that this is not going to be a smoggy, ward politics-dominated kind of town. This is something different. This was warm weather. This was sunshine. This was starting over from scratch. This was the frontier of America for a new post-war affluent area. And that, I think, is really how Phoenix defined itself against those eastern cities. This that whole sort of frontier ethos about the opportunity that lies out west, the newness. That's actually what makes Phoenix very much alike a lot of the other cities that are booming and growing in this period. Not only Los Angeles, which, you know, really sort of grows a little bit earlier, but San Diego is a great example. Denver, actually, Phoenix actually starts growing far earlier than that, but they're all sort of playing into this idea about a new post-war economy with far more intricate, far more skilled manufacturing, not just for consumers, but also for the military as well.
When you mentioned San Diego, Los Angeles, Denver, there's a feeling that Phoenix has an inferiority complex, and that's why sometimes the city and the state of Arizona do some things that might be considered pretty wacky, partly because, well, we're not going to let these other cities tell us what to do.
You know, it's really funny. A dear friend of mine wrote that came out right about the same time. This is my friend Jonathan Bell, wrote a book called California Crucible. And we always joke that we should actually have written a book together about how Phoenix and California are in the great California cities that you were talking about, actually, you know, define themselves against one another. And for the Phoenix inferiority complex, you know, it's really funny. When you look in the early sort of stages of the book, the Phoenix boosters, those from the Chamber of Commerce, are going to urban California. They're looking at what the San Diego, the Los Angeles, and the San Francisco Chambers of Commerce have done to become cities that really are deeply enmeshed in the military-industrial complex coming out of World War One, and looking for ideas about how to get that kind of investment. And then you see that in the 1930s. You actually see it right after World War II, when the Chamber of Commerce is asking itself, how can we get new investment for all of these things pulling out? We have these empty factories that have now been abandoned. What do we do now? But the interesting thing about it is, you know, in the process of flat-out stealing industry, they do define themselves against high-tax, unionized California, and pass a lot of things in order to compete with California. My favorite example in the book is when you look at Sandra Day O'Connor about why she and her husband came back from the Bay Area, because they were both educated. They got their law degrees at Stanford, and then they did go overseas for a bit. Well, why did they go to Arizona? So they could take a part of that kind of politics. And again and again and again, William Rehnquist chooses to come to Arizona. It's true he hates Midwestern winters. He's from the West. But he comes because he says that he thought of Arizona as the last frontier for free enterprise. And that's how it was defining itself, against California, as at the same time that California, until the rise of Ronald Reagan, defining itself against Arizona, I think at least.
Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, she's a history professor at Loyola of Chicago and is author of the book Sunbelt Capitalism, Phoenix and the Transformation of American Politics. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. For the perspectives of a native Arizonan on some of the theories in Sunbelt capitalism, I turn to attorney and scholar Grady Gamage. Grady, good morning.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm great. Do you think Elizabeth Shermer focused on the right things, the relationships, the turning points, for example, for Phoenix?
Well, I do. I've actually read the book, and I commend it to anyone who's interested in Arizona history. It's a very good book. What's interesting about the book is that she explores this early linkage between the sort of Republican establishment, as epitomized by Barry Goldwater, and the local business leaders, and the marriage that happened there, where I think one of her phrases in the book is that the Phoenix City Council at one point became basically a subcommittee of the Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
But here's what's interesting, Steve, to me, is how that has changed to today. And I would really like to think about bringing her work up to date, because if you look at it now, the Republican business establishment is quite often at odds with the legislature. Think about just what's happened in the last couple of weeks between GPAC and the various businesses in Arizona and what the legislature thinks are priorities. Something changed. And I'd be really interested to try to think about why and how that happened to where the sort of Tea Party, libertarian, seems to have turned into sort of an anti-big business climate in Arizona these days.
You know, Grady, there are some who, and Evan Meekum is mentioned in the book, and there are some who talk about Evan Meekum being the Tea Party before there was a Tea Party. Is there still that lingering feeling in Arizona that that's lingered for the past 25 years or so?
Yeah, I think there is some of that. Meekum clearly resented the sort of business establishment old guard Republicans in Arizona, and there's been a strain of that continuing on. What Shermer's book does is it looks at Phoenix as a sort of early harbinger of the transformation of American politics, where the modern conservative movement, as epitomized by Goldwater and Reagan, arose. I think the same thing can be said of Arizona and the Tea Party. We're sort of a harbinger of the early rise of the Tea Party and the more libertarian and the more anti-big business strain, populist strain of the modern Republican Party. We're always kind of ahead of the curve about these things somehow.
What about, is there this natural pull that I theorize there is, that Phoenix is always trying to not be a mini LA, and from a political standpoint, Los Angeles is much more to the left than Phoenix is?
Yeah, you know, it's a love-hate relationship. I think in the era in which Sunbelt Capitalism chronicles Phoenix, there was much more sort of an envy of the employment base of Los Angeles, and particularly the defense industries there, and what was going on. But we always kind of, you know, we wanted to have that much employment, but without the smog and maybe not quite as many freeways, at least in the Eugene Pulliam era. We were anti-LA. And as LA has turned increasingly blue in its politics, I think we have turned increasingly red in our politics.
And you mentioned the different relationship that the legislature has with the business community now. Do you see that changing at all as we move forward, even if we don't change anything, whether it relates to term limits or clean elections? Do you think something like SB 1062 and even the Medicaid expansion from the last legislative session might change people toward a little bit more of what we would label moderate?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you look at the enormous groundswell of opposition to 1062, my sense is that took the legislature by surprise. They didn't really expect essentially all business in Arizona to turn against them on this issue. And I think it's sort of a cumulative effect of Arizona always being in the spotlight about stuff. And some of this is very unfair to Arizona. I mean, there are things that happen all over the country, but somehow we're always the one that gets singled out and looked at as being crazy and weird. But I think that's beginning to have, I hope, a moderating effect. And, you know, as the state continues to grow, the electorate has become increasingly moderate. The elected officials, perhaps not, but maybe that's just a lagging effect that it takes a while for that to catch up.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with attorney and scholar Grady Gamage. The jumping-off point is the new book, Sunbelt Capitalism, by Elizabeth Tandy Shermer of Loyola of Chicago. Grady, the book mentions the impact of Motorola coming to the Valley. Even when I talked with Elizabeth, she mentions how Phoenix stole Motorola in some ways. You and I have talked in the past about the lack of headquarters. Does Phoenix, obviously Apple's expanding to Mesa, but does Phoenix or does the Valley need a Motorola Redux, another big company to move here and make its headquarters here?
Yeah, we do. And, you know, it's interesting. I remember Dan Noble, who was the guy who brought Arizona, brought Motorola to Arizona. He was a friend of my father's, and I remember going as a little kid to dinner to meet him. And the science library at ASU is named after him. We do need that. We need businesses that feel rooted to Arizona. But the reality is that those are few and far between and are diminishing. The entire economy of the world and of the United States is more global and more movable and less rooted than it was in the past. And here's a difference between the Motorola era and today's era. In the era in which we lured Motorola to come here, it was all about sort of a generally good business climate. Where I think the transition began to occur with distrust of big business is when we began to do incentives and special tax deals for individual businesses as opposed to fixing the overall tax structure. That's clearly where many of the more libertarian-oriented interests, the Gold Order Institute, for example, parted company with what had been the pro-business attitude. Is, okay, it's good to have overall low taxes, but what they would say to you is there has to be a level playing field for everyone. We shouldn't be handing out individualized tax breaks. Well, that is the way business is lured today, and much of that is because of globalization. That's how other countries do it. So that's increasingly how states in America do it, and we've been a reluctant player in that. And that's, I think, where the tension began and the break began between the more libertarian view and the classical pro-business conservative view.
Do Phoenix and Arizona have the leaders, whether political or business, to lead us in a particular direction? And do you see any, oh, I don't know, backlash is too strong a term, but folks like yourself who are natives and have a sense of the history of this place and folks who are coming in and want to change it, can we see enough collaboration there?
Well, you know, we talk about this sort of vacuum of leadership notion all the time. I think part of the problem that's occurred in Arizona is because we're such an open place. It's easy for somebody to move here and get elected to the legislature 5 years after they moved here. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing that we're open and we accept newcomers and want them to be integrated into the economy. But that often means that the people who get elected in Arizona don't care as much about Arizona as they do about a particular political ideology or position. And it's their loyalty is not to advancing the interests of the state, but to advancing the interests of a particular political persuasion. And that, I think, has distorted the political climate in Arizona compared to other states.
Native Arizonan, attorney and scholar Grady Gamage. Grady, thanks for the time, as always.
Anytime. Good to talk to you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear about what it's like to return from the battlefield, and we'll take a look at how the Phoenix Coyotes are going to fare post-Olympic break. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by SRP Trees for Change. Help take action to reforest Arizona land destroyed by fire. Learn more at srptreesforchange.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. It'll be partly sunny in Phoenix today, a high of 81. 77 was our high yesterday. Partly cloudy skies tonight with a low of 56. It'll be partly sunny tomorrow. We'll see some changes beginning on Friday when the skies will cloud up and there's a 20% chance of showers, a high of 76. Stay with us at 12 o'clock for NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Today, Republicans in the U.S. House are proposing to simplify the federal tax code. And why are Latinos lagging behind when it comes to enrolling for Obamacare? NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. It's mostly sunny and 72 degrees in Phoenix at 11:40.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thousands of U.S. soldiers have been returning to so-called normal lives as the nation's involvement in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is winding down. But the transition is hugely challenging for the vets and their families. Tonight at 7 on Arizona State's Tempe campus, retired U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Jake Kopelman will present the Barrett Honors College's Rhodes Lecture. It's called From Baghdad to America, Life After War. Kopelman also wrote a best-selling book with a similar title, From Baghdad to America, Life After War for a Marine and His Rescued Dog. Jay Kopelman joins me in studio right now. Jay, were you diagnosed with PTSD?
Mild PTSD. I think it's more just I have a bad temper. So that's certainly one of the ways in which it's manifested. And so people should look for that, for sudden outbursts, hypervigilance, hyperreactivity, overprotectiveness. Those are some of the ways that it's manifested. Also, sleeplessness, which was the big thing for me with the bad temper. Mm-hmm. I was, for probably 6 years or so, I slept 3 to 4 hours a night if I was lucky. Okay. Also, nightmares for those who do sleep. Becoming paralyzed in a given situation that normally would not do that to somebody, you know, if there's an incident that reminds one of the experiences that they had, then, you know, certainly those are all things to look for.
It would make sense, though, wouldn't it, if you go in with a personality with a temper anyway, that being in a situation on a battlefield would make that worse for anybody?
It could, right. So anything that you have, any of those things I've just described are going to be magnified afterward. Mm. And, you know, unless you're a sociopath going in, you're somehow going to be affected coming out. And I think that it's just based a lot on your earlier life and experiences, too, as to just how affected you're going to become. Mm. So some people are more susceptible than others.
How big an issue is that as we have more soldiers coming back?
Well, it's going to remain an issue. I mean, so it's a big issue now, but there are more opportunities for people to get treatment than there used to be, and more people are taking that opportunity than we had seen in the past. Previously, having PTSD was seen as a sign of weakness, was stigmatized. Those who admitted to having anything wrong were ostracized. But the highest levels of the DOD and all of the service chiefs have said that that's not going to be the case, that we're going to provide the help that's needed to people. And so whether that's in the form of counseling or chemistry or a combination of both, along with other non-traditional types of treatment and therapies, then you know, we're going to see improvements in that arena.
Have you been encouraged by what you've seen and people who've actually gone through treatment and seen some improvement?
Yes, absolutely. The problem with not getting the treatment is then the psychological injury, because that's what it is. So it's like any other injury. If you don't fix it, it won't heal. It festers and worsens. And then we have all the attendant problems that result from that, such as broken marriages, broken families, loss of a job, and then ultimately leading to oftentimes alcohol and drug abuse and then homelessness.
How do we measure what the value is of going to war, being in battle?
So how have we always measured it, right? What is a measure of success or failure? If we measure it in we killed more of them than they killed of us, then we've had overwhelming success, right? If you measure it as was there a clearly stated and defined mission with clear, well-defined objectives, and did we accomplish all those objectives leading to the successful accomplishment of a mission, it's a lot fuzzier than being able to say unequivocally we have the statistics and the data that show, you know, we have more and they have less. And so I'm not sure how we measure the value of going to war in, you know, for the last 13 years. I'm not sure at this point how we would measure that, whether I can say we have not had overwhelming success. If you look at what's happening in Iraq right now, the Al-Qaeda's moved back into Fallujah. All the work we did there, all the lives that were lost there, it seems to be for naught. It's really frustrating. It's horribly frustrating.
Did you know when you left the battlefield what you were going to do? Did you feel confident about what your next step was going to be? Did you feel like people who loved you and those who were close to you understood what you were coming back from, and then the transition was going to be certainly not smooth, but not as bumpy? And how bumpy was it?
Well, when I left the battlefield, I was still on active duty, and that's where I had intended to stay. So when I came back, I didn't really have to worry about that transition. I had to transition into being around people other than Marines, yeah, and soldiers. But so that was interesting. And we were having some people over for dinner and couldn't help but listen to these people and think just how clueless they really were about the big picture, about life in general and the world around them, because they were so insulated in their little worlds. Their biggest concerns was, you know, it seemed to be that they couldn't get the temperature right in their wine cellars. You know, this was a major issue for them. And, you know, talking about how wonderful their kid is, and when I knew for a fact that their kids were out getting stoned every day, and, you know, you've got to be kidding me. This is your life. And when this all came up, I said something really inappropriate at the time, and I can't remember what it was. It kind of, you know, just shut down the conversation. Young men are being killed every day, you know, who aren't much older than their children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just have no awareness of it. So I think that was a big adjustment.
Retired U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Jay Kopelman. He's presenting the Barrett Honors College Rhodes Lecture tonight at 7 on ASU's Tempe campus. The presentation is called From Baghdad to America, Life After War. Jay, thanks for the time today.
Thank you very much, Steve.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. When the National Hockey League season opened last fall, there was actually optimism in the Valley. The Phoenix Coyotes actually had new ownership that seemed to want to keep the team here and was willing to spend some money, at least more than the NHL, which was recently running the organization. but the team's play has been inconsistent, and a postseason spot is far from guaranteed. Now with the Olympics break over, the Coyotes return to the ice on Thursday night in Winnipeg. With me for a few minutes is Dave Vest, Senior Director of News Content for the Coyotes. How would you characterize the pre-Olympic break season for the Coyotes? It seems like they've played well against the good teams and not so well against the teams that aren't so good.
Yeah, that's a perfect description, Steve. As the Coyotes prepare to start this very important stretch run, hopefully to the playoffs, there's 24 games to go here in the regular season, they are not in the playoff field as we sit here today. They're just on the outside by a hair, tied with 8th place Dallas, but they lose the tiebreaker, so they're 9th place. So if the playoffs started today, which they don't, they'd be out. But having said that, exactly what you said earlier, the Coyotes seem to play to the level of their competition. They've played outstanding games against Pittsburgh's and Chicago's and the teams of that stature, but they struggle against the Buffaloes and some of the other teams that aren't going to be in the playoffs. And if you ask Coach Tippett about it, that's really something that's been puzzling him all season. It's something that he's hoping that this team can rectify. He's looking for them to play every game as if they're playing an elite opponent.
How much an impact did losing Captain Shane Doan to that mysterious illness for a while, how much did that hurt the team?
I think it hurt significantly. If you look at the way Shane played before he became ill, he was having a very good season, one of the better seasons he's had in a while. When Shane reported to training camp, a lot of us that have been around the team every day for a long time were very impressed by the physical condition that Shane was in. He was very active in the off season, getting into terrific shape. He was a lot thinner. He was a lot leaner. He had a look in his eye like he had something to prove, and he started the season quite well. Then, as we all know, he took ill there at the beginning of December and was lost for a huge chunk of the season. And having said that, you know, if you look at the stats for the Coyotes, Shane is still right up there among the team leaders in the offensive category. So losing him really, really did hurt.
What do you think the team's strengths are as we go into this final playoff push?
The team's main strength is the fact that there is not a superstar on this team, and they all know that. So the guys know in order for them to win, they all have to play a very specific role, and they have to play it well. And if one or two or three of them don't, they're not going to be successful. I think that's a strength. I think if you ask Coach Tippett, he prefers a team like that to a team full of superstars. I think they're very strong defensively. You've got Oliver Ekman-Larsson and Keith Yandle. They're two young defensemen who are very strong offensively. Ekman-Larsson played in the Olympics. Yandle was just cut from the USA team. He was one of the last players not selected, so they're strong back there. And I think Mike Smith will be a strength, too. Mike's going to be coming back from the Olympics. He did not play there, but talking to him today, he was playing very well before the Olympics. He's just on cloud nine after winning a gold medal with Canada. So I think you're going to see that in his play moving forward.
Dave, are you anticipating any advantages or disadvantages for teams that sent a lot of players to the Olympics who played and didn't get the break, and the teams that did have players who got a break?
Absolutely. I think the teams that sent a lot of players, they're going to suffer, at least at the very beginning of the resumption of the schedule. The Chicago Blackhawks, I believe they sent 10 players. That's half the team over to the Olympics. And I think what we're going to see, you know, this is just a prediction of mine and a gut feeling, I think you're going to see them struggle a little bit to get back to where they had been playing. Now, they're an elite team in the league, so that's asking a lot. But I think teams that sent 10 and 9 and 8 players over there, I think you're going to see them struggle just a little bit to get back into the groove playing on the NHL surface.
Most of the last few seasons were spent trying to figure out what the NHL was going to do with the Coyotes, whether there'd be stable ownership. Coming into this season, that seems to be a real positive at this point. How have the fans responded? How has attendance been? And is there this feeling that in order for the team to make a good push, they're going to need even more support for those home games?
Yeah, I'm eager to see how this plays out because, you know, we're going into the final stretch of the season here. The NFL season is now over. Baseball hasn't started. So I'm eager to see how the fans come out for these games here as we resume at the end of February and early March. There's only 11 home games left in the regular season. I'm expecting the crowds to be pretty good. You know, so far in the season, it's been kind of hard to figure out. You know, we've had some very, very good crowds. There were other nights during the week early in the season, which is always a hard sell for the Coyotes. But I think all in all, it's trending upward, and I think now that there's this buzz, if you will, from the Olympics. You know, a lot of people watched the Olympics and saw hockey for the first time, and, you know, they saw Oliver Ekman-Larsson playing. He's, you know, obviously one of the building blocks the Coyotes have in place. He's a very young player. They got to see Lauri Korpikoski win a bronze medal. I think there's some excitement there that, you know, fans here in the Valley will use and come out to see what the Coyotes are up to.
Finally, here's my loaded question. As we mentioned, the Coyotes are just barely out of the playoffs now. Will they make the playoffs or not?
I think they will. I'm confident that Mike Smith is going to come back and perform well. Just talking to Mike and seeing his body language today after coming back from the Olympics, Mike is ready to have a big 24-game stretch here. And if you remember from when the Coyotes succeeded 2 years ago, you know, Mike Smith played a huge role in that, and the Coyotes kind of rode him into the Western Conference Final. I think he's set up to repeat that. I think he's poised for a big run.
Dave Vest is Senior Director of News Content for the Coyotes. Dave, thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The Academy Awards will be presented on Sunday in Hollywood, closer to home on Thursday night at the AMC Arizona Center Theaters in downtown Phoenix. You'll be able to attend the top 20 public screening of the Almost Famous Film Festival's Short Film Challenge. And with me for a few minutes is the festival's executive director, Jay Stotz. Jay, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
Good to have you with us. What's the motivation behind a short film festival like Almost Famous?
Well, I think it just gives the opportunity to filmmakers throughout Arizona a chance to make a film. A lot of the time people want to do this, but without having sort of a goal or an end goal in mind, they don't get around to doing it. So by hosting a challenge like we do every year, it gives them a purpose, and it's a lot of fun. And the end result is having a bunch of people come and watch your movies on a big screen, just like they do in Hollywood.
What do you hear from folks, and you've been a filmmaker yourself as well, what are the challenges of doing something that is... that is short. Obviously, they only have 48 hours to put it together, but I'm sure people have ideas where I'd love to make this a 20-minute film, but I'm restricted to 1 to 5.
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the unique aspects of our festival is that the guidelines we give out each year, which are a theme, a line of dialogue, and a prop, they're very, the teams are able to put them into their films without making their film look like it was done for a 48-hour challenge. Mm. So we always encourage them, once the festival is done, to either take the footage that they've already shot or to go shoot new footage and edit these into longer pieces and submit them to other film festivals around the country.
So, Jay, what were some of the guidelines folks needed to include for this festival?
This year's theme was temptation, which was, I think, a very good one. The line of dialogue was, this should be interesting, and the prop was a button, and we always assign an action to it. So we had to have a character press a button, and it could be anything from a button on a shirt to an emotional button. We got a lot of really, really cool ones. I think this year the most common was the belly button.
Okay. Now, you had 49 entries. Is that right? Did you watch all 49?
Yeah, we had 61 teams this year, and we had 49 make the 48-hour deadline, and I did. We have 5 judges, and I am one of them. And this year, I think something that was really special for the filmmakers is we had Chris Lepps from Hollywood as one of our judges, and he is Johnny Depp's stuntman. So he's in all the Pirates of the Caribbean films, and he actually watched and scored all the films. So I thought that was really cool for the filmmakers to have that.
Now, I imagine when you're watching these films, people have different creative ideas. They go about it differently. Mm-hmm. Did you see the whole spectrum of usage from a 1 to 5 minute film? Were you seeing things that were romance, adventure, comedy?
Yes, we see from the full spectrum of the whole gamut of films. We have anything from comedies, where it's kind of that college humor, all the way to something where your eyes definitely get teared up and it's an emotional drama. So I think the filmmakers do a really good job. This year we had a few that actually traveled kind of outside the Phoenix area and filmed in the mountains in Flagstaff and Prescott. Someone even did sort of a plane crash movie. One of the films that's really funny was a person went back in time and accidentally killed George Lucas, so he had to remake Star Wars. So we get lots of creative ideas.
Are the people who enter typically budding filmmakers, or is there a broader group than that?
You know, it's both. There's budding filmmakers. We've actually had quite a few of the filmmakers from our challenge go on to Hollywood and some success. And actually, just in the news, Ryan Anderson, who won the Doritos contest this year for his commercial Time Machine, he started out with the A3F. And we also have the other side. We have people that just enter once a year, and that's the only film they make, and they get their friends and family to help them out. So anything from amateurs to the seasoned pros.
Jay Stotz is executive director of the Almost Famous Film Festival Short Film Challenge. You can catch the top 20 tomorrow night at 7 at the AMC Arizona Center Theaters in Phoenix. Jay, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much.
That's all for this edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Nick Blumberg for his help. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear this or any of our past programs, go online to kjzz.org this afternoon. You can also download the KJZZ app to your phone. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. We hope you have a great rest of the day. It is 12 o'clock.